Welcome to the Truth to Power Show and Radio for Brooklyn. I'm your host, VJR Nathan, and we're here with Jared Harrell, a poet in Queens, fellow poet in Queens. Jared and I met many years ago when I was doing a library, trying to find poets for a library open mic, and I asked one of the Brooklyn poets that I happened to know, and he recommended Jared, and then I was so fond of his work that I asked him to review my first self-published collection, Escape from Samsara. He's so kind to give me some very insightful and very critical of reviews, insightful comments on the manuscript, Escape from Samsara, which now is many years old, 2016, I think it was, that I published it. And, it's interesting to see your evolution, Jared, as well, from Body Double, which is very much, I believe, a single man's, poem, very much a single man's existential crisis or whatever, kind of a thing, that, and then evolving into a husband and a father, as you go along, go because I love you. It kind of seems like about marriage, and so I slowly getting into the parenthood, and so we'll talk a little bit about that and the evolution of your own psyche over the years, and how you see it. And how you kind of experience it as the observational, keen observational eye. Yeah.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, VJ. Yeah, and I think you're right. It's been we're coming on a decade of maybe knowing each other. It's amazing.
Yeah.
How time flies. But I think that's, I like the way you put that. Yeah, I think the Body Double really was sort of single young man who wakes up one day to find his doppelganger living with him. And the two sort of get along / don't get along. And it's very much in that world. And I think Go Because I Love You, my first full-length collection, is really a coming-of-age collection. Half the poems were written before I was a parent, half them afterwards. And it's really about that transition of living for yourself to living for others. And what that transition is like for the speaker is becoming kind of a young parent to one and then two babies. And then this new collection, Let Our Bodies Change the Subject, which came out in September from University of Nebraska Press, is a collection that is really knee deep in parenthood. I have two children, an 11-year-old daughter and an 8-year-old son now, and they show up in the collection a lot to their tremendous delight. We'll see if that continues on as they hit their teenage years. But this was the first collection for me that I felt like I was really steeped in that world of domesticity, of the interiors of being a father, a parent, and having that sort of lens through which to kind of view the world,
Yeah.
So yeah, really great. The way you kind of put that.
Yeah. It's really great that you demonstrate that being a parent doesn't have to consume you, in the sense that you can be observational and be self-reflective while being a parent and continue that search and journey inward, modeling for parents that they don't have to be consumed by their duties as parents, but rather they can continue to keep the observational eye on themselves and continue the self-development, and through writing and creativity, and they don't have to be consumed by the talk,
Yeah, I think actually even more than that, I found one thing I really enjoyed about parenthood, as from the point of view of a writer, is that kids are always seeing the world anew. They're always seeing it through fresh eyes. And so actually, it can be a really great tool through which to see the world. Because as I think as writers, we're always trying to see the world anew, to see it through fresh eyes, to sort of wipe away that the found language of our lives, sort of the filters that we're taught and that we kind of build through, growing up. Kids have none of that. They'll see something and they'll see it as though for the first time. And I think writers are always trying to make it new, trying to see things anew. And so in that sense, kids, being a parent was a great way to re-enter that state. Of course, there's a lot of roadblocks with being a parent, one of which, your time suddenly becomes, much more diminished and more valuable. But actually, it was interesting because suddenly, I didn't have these larger swaths of time to write. It really made me become a more resourceful writer. I really had to be dedicated in the hours I did have. I'd find myself, when the kids were really young, trying to revise a poem while pushing a stroller down, around Queens and so on and so forth, and kind of keeping the poems in my head and double tasking. And I think my habit of keeping a notebook and a pen in my pocket really developed from that idea of being resourceful, because I couldn't start becoming a writer when I sat down to write. If I did that, then I would have so little time. So it forced me to sort of pay attention to the world more keenly all the time, and to really kind of take those opportunities and those pockets of time when they came. So yeah, single biggest roadblock, and also single biggest kind of jump starter for writing was becoming apparent for me.
Yeah, it's great how you slow down things and able to like bring in existential themes as well, kind of themes around like the big questions, the big, unknowns into the everyday life. So that then, and a lot of this invited by the inquiry of your children, kind of asking questions and bringing in these bigger questions. And the opening poem of the book, which we'll get into, the biggest question about death comes up, and kind of these existential questions and the ways in which the children may ask questions around these big questions that a lot of times are left to the scholars and the religious mendicants, the religious people,
Sure.
but children as well feel like open terrain to ask questions around these kinds of themes. So maybe we can just kick it off with the poetry reading, and then we can go into a little bit more into community after that. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I think you're right. I think, and we were talking about this a little bit before we started recording, this idea that, like, for me, parenthood made the world like this stranger, brighter, more magical, but also far scarier place. And I think those themes of love and death, which I think are in so much of our writing, some people argue the two themes of writing are love and death, but I think for me, those two became much more in focus becoming,
Yeah.
the world became a scarier place, and it also a brighter, more loving place.
Yeah, it's
So
always
yeah.
scary. Yeah, it's always scary in its unspecificity when it's not specific in the when it's a diffuse fog. But it's not as scary when you landed in a point in time. Then you can wrestle with it a little more specifically,
Yeah, I think the poem you're referring to is actually the opening poem in my collection. It's called Sad Roller Coaster. And this one, it's this poem takes place in and around New York City. It's a very Queens book, but this poem goes everywhere from Queens to Coney Island and around. And it took place over the course of a summer in which my daughter, questioned by incisive question, came to understand death in her own way. And it sort of culminates at Coney Island at the Cyclones baseball game, where it kind of clicks for her. And you'll see that happen in the poem. The poem is called Sad Roller Coaster. My daughter is in the kitchen working out death. She wants to get it, how it tastes and feels. Her teacher talks like it's some glittery gold sticker. Her classmates hear rumors, launch it as a curse when toys aren't shared. Between bites of cantaloupe, she considers what she knows. Her friend's grandpa lives only in her iPad. Dr. Seuss passed, but keeps speaking in rhyme. We go to Queen's Zoo and spot the beakish skull of a white-tailed deer tucked between rocks in the puma's enclosure. It's just for show, I explain, explaining nothing. That night, and the one after, my daughter dreams of bones, how they lift out of her skin and try on her dresses. So silly, she laughs when I ask if she's okay. Then, toward the back end of summer, we head to Coney Island to catch a Cyclones game. We buy popcorn and fries that pop fly arcs over checkerboard grass. When past the warning track, the park wall, she sees a giant wooden spine, this brownish red maze traced in decay. She calls it Sad Roller Coaster, then begs to be taken home.
Thank you. Yeah,
So
it's just,
yeah, I think those themes of love and death are kind of circling around.
do you find like that innocent inquiry into that you're able to like bring something? Do you feel like you're bringing something? You're just observing like what you're going on, or to what extent do you bring in your own kind of well, this won't be very observational. You're kind of keeping neutral around making any kind of interjection of your own viewpoint, but a lot of poets will be like resist, but not be able to resist the idea of like throwing in some highfalutin, philosophical, the ability to restrain, I see there, the
Oh,
ability
I
to restrain
appreciate that.
yourself.
You know, one thing about the poem, and I think about the experience that I realized was that even as a parent, I had no good answers for her. She had these large questions that she started thinking about that, of course, all of us think about. And I didn't have any good answers, as these questions came up. And I think, so much of being a parent is realizing you don't have the answers, but you can be there for them. I don't have all the answers for them. Like that point where we're at the zoo, and I say it's just for show. I explaining nothing. Like, what do you mean it's just for show? It's a skull. What, and so it's the parent also being there for his daughter, but also realizing he only can help so much. And I think there's
I think
a
that's
little
a
bit of that.
positive thing because many people, kind of know-it-alls, will be like coming in there, strong with their highfalutin answers. But as Socrates said, to know that you don't know is a lot of restraint to be like, oh, I'm not gonna impose some kind of a, like, the kid doesn't know anything. And if you look at the books or whatever, or you look at the religious traditions, obviously it has to do with, saffrons, whatever it is, whatever, like angels and whatever it is that you want to throw in there. Some poets, especially classical poets, will be like very quick to like be like, this child, she's about to get initiated into, whatever it is. You know what I mean?
I don't
So,
know if Socrates was a parent, but I think becoming a parent is a very humbling experience. You realize very soon how little you know.
Well,
You know, you're
he had all those students that he had to parent in a sense.
you know.
Had all those students he had to kind of coach or whatever. But yeah, it's interesting. And like, where you're heading, and as the children get older, if you continue to, any new works you've been working on since this, now it's been like 6 months, I think, since this book published. And where do you feel like you're moving towards, as a poet? We'll talk a little bit about that, and then we'll move to community.
Yeah, no, it's a good question because, like I said, my kids are 11 and 8, and they really like being in my poems. My first book was dedicated to them, and when my daughter saw it in the book, she was like, "Oh, I'm famous, I'm famous." And I'm like, "Oh, you don't quite understand the poetry landscape. You're not remotely famous." But she really was proud of being in these poems, and she still is. But she's 11, and I think her privacy is becoming something that's more important to her. And as I'm curious, as a writer, how I'm going to sort of navigate that terrain when I value my daughter's and my son's privacy, and I also they show up a lot in my work. It's hard for me to write truthful, honest work without them being part of it because they're such a big part of my life. And so I think that's something that my future work is navigating and trying to wrestle with, how to write true poems and also how to respect their individuality as they grow up. Actually, there's a new poem that was published a couple months ago in The Sun that is talking about that transition a little bit. I can read that one if you'd like. So it's a poem that it's not in the book, but it was published a couple months ago, and it's called Last Bath, and it's about my two kids taking a bath together. And realizing that there's not many times this is going to happen anymore. They're already sort of aging out of it a little bit, and realizing that this is a very temporary thing. The two kids taking a bath together, and realizing kind of what I'm talking about, that they're going to grow up and become their own individuals pretty soon, and more well-defined individuals rather. So this is poem's called Last Bath. It hasn't happened yet. The awkward bloom of my children's bodies, the bathroom pin lock pushed in, the steady stream of marathon showers, bolts of thick steam, all shadowy blue. They're still here, together, the two of them like seal pups in a porcelain tub as it brims with bubbles, rubber fish, spongy green letters speckled with mold. How long till toy ships are docked and moored? It hasn't happened yet. But just yesterday, my daughter asked for privacy before brushing her teeth of all things. That delicate word out there on her lips, like new fruit. I almost laughed, but nodded instead. The white door before me, the knob, the click.
Thank you, thank you. Yeah, again, the keen eye for the sensory detail, the observational kind of what you're seeing is then, microscope, taking a microscope to it to be able to, reflect the larger themes by looking at what is it that I think it was William Carlos Williams said about no ideas but in things, right?
Yeah,
So,
not ideas, but in
yeah.
things. And I think what he was getting at is that that thing that which I often teach my students as well, that idea that specificity is universal.
Yeah.
Trying to get at those universal things, it's
Yeah.
really hard to tackle it, with a wide lens. The easier
Yeah.
way to do it is to tackle it through the specific.
Yeah.
If I, tell my students to write about love with a capital L, like what are they going to start with? Write about death. But if I tell them to write about the loss of their, their pet or a loved one or, their first kiss, then suddenly they have something really concrete and specific with which to anchor those much larger ideas and emotions. And if you think
Yeah.
like, your favorite like characters in literature, and favorite books and favorite TV shows, you don't like them because they're vague, because they're general, because they could be anybody. You like them because you feel like you know them, because they're so specific that that you feel like you know that person, and then it taps into all these larger themes. And I think really that's kind of the foundation of literature, this idea that specificity is universal, that through telling our own stories, through navigating the world we see and how we see it, we can stretch past race, gender, countries, centuries. We can read people who are, lived hundreds of years ago and still connect to them. Because there's
Yeah.
that underlying humanity through it, that through line that's kind of uncovered through specificity.
Yeah, a lot of people will think about patterns in a blinding way, be like, oh, it's all the same or it's all repeating. And then you end up coming shutters over your eyes and not able to see like, well, how specifically is it repeating? And like, how can we really lean into that repetition in order to be empowered rather than disempowered? Because like, then we know kind of we have a heads up kind of like what's happening in our life, and we're able to lean into that theme so that then we can feel empowerment rather than hopelessness. As a therapeutic modality, a lot of times people will fall into these patterns of like it's all happening every day, same stuff. And I'm like, well, how specifically is how I really lean into that specificity as you're saying, so that then you can feel like owning it rather than being disempowered, disenfranchised by it. So I think it
Yeah,
works
no.
along with that. Yeah, therapeutic model.
That makes sense. That's really interesting. And I think, if we were bored by those tropes, by those stories, then all those stories have already been written, like another love story, another heartbreak story, another story about a mother and father, another story about a grandparent passing away. Like all that stuff has been written, and we'd find that stuff truly boring, but we
Yeah.
don't. New stuff comes out all the time that we find fascinating, and it's not because we haven't read that story, it's because we haven't read that specific story. It's the specificity. It's making it new, making it, getting us reinvested all over again. And I think, we're not jaded. We just, as if it's done well, then we see the proof in literature and film and all that stuff all around us. It's not that we get jaded at all. It's that when the stuff is, when the stuff strikes a chord and is specific enough and is truthful enough, then we're right there. We'll take another heartbreak story, another love story any day,
Yeah, we talked a little bit about this before recording, but about dreams. Like, I started getting really involved as I started to go to Jung Library, Carl Jung Library. I became interested in the unconscious and how the unconscious operates as like a blender for the different aspects of society and for our life, and our dreams being that blender, like blending together all these conscious tropes and all these conscious modalities and putting it together in a new or fresh way. So definitely, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We're discussing on my phone starting to spiral out, but specifying how dreams might be a modality to look to, how they
Yeah, it was
reflect,
interesting. You
yeah.
were saying how How you wrote a whole collection based on dreams. I have a lot of trouble remembering my dreams. Really, if anything, just snippets. But I've heard, and maybe you know this better than me, I heard that if you get into the practice of writing down your dreams, then you actually are more likely to remember them.
Yeah,
That it's like a
exactly.
sort of prophecy.
Once you start to make a conscious effort to wake up, set not an alarm, but you wake up naturally in the middle of the night, then you quickly make some notes. Then slowly, your mind starts to get trained to at least for a time period. If you set a like a 5 week or 4 week, time period on it that you're tracking, you're able to like track. So I tracked like a few months. Track the dreams, and then I wrote down as much as I could. And then out of that, I harvested the best or the most interesting. And then I wrote a poem like inspired by, basically, or just kind of working out the construction of. They call it active imagination when you're like basically just kind of like filling in the blanks or kind of trying to plug in whatever doesn't make sense to make it make sense, kind of in a way. Yeah,
That's
but
that sounds fascinating. I might try it. I might try because I
yeah.
always sometimes I wake up being like, that was something happened. A lot happened there, but
Yeah.
I couldn't for the life of me remember what it was.
Yeah. Now it's good to write down some quick notes, and then when you later in the creative process, you can try to make some assumptions, or because it is your dream ultimately, so it probably has something to do with referencing something in your life. So you can always put make some creative assumptions there. But and there's
Yeah,
so
that
much
makes
to be
sense.
said about dreams and group dreaming and community. Like when we did a modality where it's like, if this were my dream, share in a group, people would share a dream. And like, if this were my dream, it would mean such and such, all those kind of things. So speaking of community and how we can build community. So we're both from Queens. I mean, I was from originally from Staten Island, but I translated into Queens and the Poet of Queens Press and all this kind of stuff. And the various ways in which Queens has become a part of your ether. But now I think you moved out of Queens, right? Now I think you're
About a
upstate.
year and a half ago, I'm still a Queens writer at heart, though.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm in Westchester for the last year and a half. My speaking of kids, my daughter and son wanted their own rooms, and I didn't want to
Yeah.
give up my office, and so we moved toward family. My brother lives in town here as well. But no, I'm still very much linked into the Queens community. The artist peer circle that I was in through QCA we're still going strong. We still meet every month via Zoom now. And just the last month we did our newest edition of Queensbound, which was really wonderful and a successful launch. Casey Trommer started Queensbound a few years ago, this idea of kind of an audio map of Queens voices through the subway system. And our new edition culminated in this wonderful reading on the 7 train, where we all sort of piled in, and it was maybe 40 of us or so. And people read poems from the new edition, and some people were there knowing they were there for the reading, and some people, were there going wherever they were going, and then suddenly it became part of the experience and really enjoyed it. And it became kind of a really wonderful community event. And was a lot of fun. And this collection, Let Our Bodies Change the Subject, was written entirely in Queens. And so it's a very, I think of it as a very Queens book. And writing, I always say, is this sort of strange solitary activity and endeavor. And because of that, I think especially community is so important. And the community I found in Queens is one that I cherish and I'm still very keyed into. And yeah, it was super helpful in the sort of creation of this book. And I launched the book. I did my launch reading at Q and Willow in Queens, and have done readings at QCA and QED and a few other spots around town. So it's been fun.
Yeah, good. Yeah, it's good to like work off each other's energy, and I really like that, and see what people are talking about, and what's kind of live in the community, alive in the community. Of course, the show itself, the Truth to Power show, kind of spotlights a lot of the local as well as broader community to see what's kind of racing in the pulse, and the different parts of that. And I'm trying to think like what else. We had a few speakers around. We had a few speakers recently around, just about like a few of the speakers we've had recently, like around culture and around different aspects of culture and different aspects of like how in one community culture and in Queens especially, how culture is so diverse, and the diversity of Queens and how each neighborhood has like a very different feel to it. I worked for many years in the Queens libraries, and each neighborhood has a very different feel, a different immigrant population, a different kind of aspects. And you're just saying that the subway can connect it all. So that's pretty good.
Yeah, the subway, I think, is a great metaphor for that. And one of the things I love about Queens is everybody is different, like you're saying with diversity. Everybody's different, and so then in a sense, everybody's the same. And I love that sort of level playing field and that true melting pot. I think America often talks about that, but I feel like it becomes a reality in Queens more than probably anywhere else that I can think of.
Yeah, the immigrant story, and the immigrant struggle around, where are we going, where we come from, how do we come together, and how do we express both the native population, the native homeland ideas, as well as bring something new to this community together where we're at right now. I think there's a big struggle around immigrant, and especially second generation or first generation. I always forget what the first generation and second generation. But first generation Americans and people have come from other places. So I know we've gone over your heritage, but before, but if you could restate for this interview, kind of a little bit more about your family background, a little bit more about pretty much restate a little bit about kind of where you're coming from, heritage.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was my father moved to Rego Park when he was about 17. So he moved here. He immigrated here. My mother's parents were from Poland originally and moved to Sweden after the Holocaust, and then they moved from there to Brooklyn. But then my mom moved from Brooklyn to Long Island, and so it was pretty funny when I moved. I was raised in Long Island, and then moved back to Queens, and was in Queens for about 16 years. I was spent about 7, 8 years in Astoria, and then 7 years in Rego Park, about just a few blocks away from where my dad, grew up and was in high school. So it was interesting kind of being back in that neighborhood of Rego Park again. And then they met in Long Island, and were raised there. So yeah, I've found myself kind of being in all different parts of downstate Queens, kind of born in Queens, grew up in Long Island, then moved back to Queens, then did my college at Binghamton and then Ithaca at Cornell, and now I'm in Westchester. So I think I have to probably retire in Buffalo and do the full New York City,
It's great. That's great. Yeah, I also thought about that with New York City because I lived at some point in all the boroughs except the Bronx. So I'll have to remember to retire in the Bronx because then I would hit all five boroughs.
Yeah, I'm sure they give you a pin, right?
Yeah, do the full tour, the complete tour. Yeah, you get to see my gold star or something like that. Yeah. But also, I was trying to get out with the intergenerational stuff. Like how you feel like if you feel like the going backwards in the family as well, go up the tier in the family since you've been going mostly focused on your immediate family, but how you've lived with your parents or grandparents or how you've lived with reversing the lens and how that if you've ever done that in your writing.
I think one thing about becoming a parent was it gave me a fresh lens and through which to kind of see my own parents and my own grandparents as people who were sort of young and winging it and doing their best. And this book is, the dedication of this book is for my parents and theirs, and kind of speaking to that intergenerational notion of it. And I can read something that kind of touches on that as well. Sure. So why don't I do that? I'll read. So this is a poem called Tefillin. Tefillin, for those of you who don't know, it refers to the Jewish practice of daily prayers. So that it has these straps and a black box with verses from the Torah inside. And some observant Jews, they'll sort of wrap this around them, do their morning prayers, take them off, and then go about their day. And I didn't come from a religious household at all. We were very secular. But this is one thing that my father would do. He would wake up, put on these tefillin, say the prayers, and then go off to work at the automotive shop. You know, my dad's a mechanic. And so this is something that he'd done my entire childhood. And then I grew up, went to college, moved out. And then one day I came back into my parents' house with my kids. You know, the power had gone out and we needed to do laundry. And I saw him doing it. And I'd forgotten that it was something he'd done. I forgot that this was a practice of his. And so this poem comes out of that sort of that practice, but also that surprise of forgetting something. And it's called Tefillin. You think you know your life till you forget your own father prays every morning, unzips a velvet pouch to wrap worn leather strips about his left arm and hand 7 times around, like dressing a wound. You forget he prays in greased blue coveralls before the workday rush of mufflers and brake pads, and that he prays on Sundays in sweatpants and socks. He sets a black box a centimeter above his hairline, slaps a yarmulke upon his skull, prays, then stops. You think you know your life, but forget your father has done this since you were six, since a thin, kindly rabbi spent a week in your home. How could you forget? It's true, your life no longer confides in you. For too long, you've been wary, screening its calls like a bookie you have lost all resources to repay. You forget your father prays the way he does paperwork, all alone and without enough light. He never makes a show of it, never once offered to teach you how. You think you know your life, until the power sparks out one snowy December morning. So you climb your parents' stairs with your two children and laundry in tow, and there's a stranger by the curtains, his eyes squeezed shut, toes arrowed toward Jerusalem, bound in black lines.
Beautiful.
It's.
Thank you. Yeah, it's interesting how you're examining like seeing something deeper, I think like, and being able to like reacquaint yourself with these traditions and seeing it from a specific standpoint of like someone you know very well, your father, but then seeing like a different side to him, a different side to his psyche, and through this practice,
The distance that's there, even amid the closest family, those black lines that
Exactly.
begin as part of the tefillin, but kind of become as a metaphor of what's unknown, the unknowable about each other, even amidst the people we're closest to,
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I think it's
and there's
interesting
something.
how we're all kind of on the edge of the unknown in the sense that and we're all kind of explorers and exploring, and there's no particular vantage point that's more prized. It's just that, your own journey is the one that guides your own heart. Your own journey is the one that ultimately guides. No one's going to tell you how, to guide your own heart or your own journey. But at the same time, we can all learn from each other, and our own journeys. We were talking a little bit about the totality that happened just recently in the interplanetary. I don't know how skeptical you are about or what the level of skepticality you have about, how what planets have to do with our life, but I do I took some classes in astrology, and I found it interesting as energetic signatures rather than thinking too much about the planet specifically or the astral body specifically. I think that gets a little mind blown, around like, oh, Jupiter's out there, but it's also in here, kind of a thing, but I think of it as energetic circles in our history and like how these energies might be represented by, our understanding of the planets rather than too specific about, planets. I don't know why this came up for me from your poem, but thinking about astrology and thinking about, energetic circles and what is the meaning behind these events. Interesting to think about. So what are your thoughts on like these on astrology or generally about like the mystery around energy circles?
Yeah, I don't know if it would be so much skepticism as ignorance. You know, it's not something I know a ton about. It's something that sounds super interesting, and I'm, you know, I for me, I find the celestial, the planetary, I find it to be almost religious. Like I
Yeah.
say, I said that, like, the most religious I've ever felt has been like at a planetarium,
Yeah.
not a church or a synagogue.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I do really, it's so awe-inspiring. It's so hard to sort of get my mind around. And I think the eclipse was a lot of fun. I took my kids and a bunch of the community went to this local park and we got to see it together. And it had reminded me that I'd actually written a poem about the Great American Eclipse, which happened in 2017.
Oh, yeah.
And I had written about the previous eclipse, which was a full eclipse from where I saw it. And it had occurred at sort of a transitional moment in my life as well. And so I was like, oh, I have an eclipse poem. I'd forgotten I'd had an eclipse poem that's actually in the book.
Yeah.
I could read that one if you'd like.
Yeah. Yeah. Why don't you read that? I'll read after that. I'll read one of my clips from that just wrote recently. So I'll give it a second for that too.
Sure, yeah. I'd love to hear that. So this one's called The Great American Eclipse, which is what they call the 2017 one, because that one, for a couple weeks went all across the country. The Great American Eclipse. I saw the decapitated sunflower of it from an arcade parking lot off Route 110. My two kids were in there, giddy, buzzing, as my mother shoved tokens into jittery fists. I stepped out. My head was killing. I could no longer take the artificial clinking of ticket dispensers and mock jackpots over stained carpet floors. Days before, I'd been let go, a phrase so passive, so incidental and plain, like the slightest ease of fingers from string. I moved past laser tag, past kids drowning in a pit of plastic balls, and that greased prize counter like an exhibit for madness. Outside, the August light had dimmed to ash. The air felt cooler and rimmed in stillness like a spacecraft over Long Island's turnpikes and malls. I thought of my children, back lit by tilt screens, wholly thrilled to be present and rich. Then suddenly I rose, up, up, and away, a small hollow orb into darkening skies.
Nice, nice. What age were you when this is the what was the age again of the speaker or the?
2017, so this is we're talking 7 years ago.
Okay, yeah. But this
Yeah.
would be a lot of so I was gonna give you the childhood stuff. So you were just
So,
saying.
I'd taken my kids to the
Oh,
arcade
you
with
did, yeah.
my parents. And so my
Oh.
kids were inside this Long Island arcade off Route 110 playing
All right.
video games. And I stepped out to see the eclipse. And it was
All
sort of
right.
that sort of juxtaposition that was going on there.
Nice, nice. That was pretty good. I liked it a lot, and I liked how the juxtaposition of the balls and the pit, and it made me think about the spinning planets. Yeah, good, good.
Love to
Yeah,
hear yours.
let me pull up mine. This has to, I just wrote up quickly, but this has to do with the totality and the surrounding controversy around in my own family. So I'll tell you a little bit more about that after we read it.
Sure,
But
go ahead.
totality. The sun chases after the sun, who will be overshadowed by the moon in the afternoon. The mother worried sick about her offspring, drowning out reason, remembering him only as adolescence, singing the praise of the Lord, telling to recite the prayer during totality. Now he's driving from NYC to Cleveland, doing 90 into 70. Drowning out the music as he smokes, parallel to a 15, the lead overtaking Kia Sorento, chug-chugging, trying desperately to keep up. Lexus behind his 2024 Mini Country Countryman, gunning up his rear, stuck in the middle with you. A flick of a cigarette could spell disaster. His firm right hand keeps the car in check. The wind is not an ally. The wind is not a savior. It is a wild card, and it races around the car and back into it again. The cigarette floats momentarily. The waiting until the few moments of totality is comprised of gas-fueled raging down 80 highway. There and back again. Had not been for physics, we'd all be down a barrel. Now, then, in the future, looking back, seeing the moments of darkness in the night of the night and day, it was worth the trouble. Maybe he'll chase, or maybe he'll settle with this feeling. The world is not enough for his ambitions. The world is never enough for ambitions. Yet this world is all there is. So we make compromises somewhere, sometime, but not this day, not today. It will never be today. Thank you. So it's interesting because my parents were like really concerned about me driving to Cleveland. They were like, oh, you know, something could bad happen or whatever it is. They had this premonition or something. But the closest I had was that, you know, I was driving like a fairly fast speed to overtake this 15-wheeler. And the Kia Sorento in front of me was like struggling to like, you know, bypass the 15-wheeler. And meanwhile, I got this Lexus in my back, you know, who was like gunning for me. He wants 130. And I'm like, oh my God. You know, I'm trying to like, I'm smoking in the meantime. So I'm trying to throw the cigarette out the window and focus.
And
And
I
like,
love how it becomes this metaphor of like the cars overtaking the cars as an eclipse, and also the music, the radio drowning out the outside world, and all that idea of things passing over and you know, moving past one another.
I use that moment as like a like kind of a parallel to the eclipse rather than focusing on the eclipse. That's good, good. I'm glad that was conveyed. And it's interesting, like you know, all these different parallels we draw as poets, you know, not looking at the thing itself, but rather a reflection of the thing. You know, I think I see that in your work as well, where we're looking at the reflection in order to get insight into the primary object.
You know, finding you know, to tell all the truth but tell it slant, as it says, you know, it's hard sometimes to tackle these things straight on. I don't think the brain actually is always wired to do that. You know, often the poem I'm trying to write is not the poem I wind up writing. You know, if I tackle something head on, it usually feels too overdetermined or, you know, a little clunky. But if I'm, you know, I have this memory in my mind or this phrase is sticking in my head, and before you know it, I'm writing about all these things that I've been thinking about, and you know, but I've come at it, you know, askew from a slant.
Because you know, it's almost too ambitious to go after the planets itself, but rather go in a grounded way. To go after what do you viscerally in your body experience rather than kind of highfalutin, you become disembodied when you talk about, you know, something that's too out there and too much in focus, but rather what is the visceral sensory experience you're having, which I think is so important, you know?
Absolutely.
All right, my listeners to the Truth to Power Show and Reading for Brooklyn. We're here with the poet Jared Harrell, and we're discussing a little bit about the poetic process. A little bit about the big themes, existentialism and the existential dread or the fears and love and fear, all these different combating forces, and how we might ground that in a somatic experience or in a real, you know, kind of visceral identity, and how that's been repeating themes throughout all of human history. And how can we begin to, as poets, we're like the observational version of you know, we think about stand-up comedy as being like, oh, well, you know, as being the kind of lighter version of that. But I think all, you know, humor is also kind of great to bring into poetry. But the point is, you know, all these different arts are always looking at the observational, the visceral observational. What can we see? What can we do with it?
The fact that you brought up stand-up comedy, I've often said that I think stand-up comedy is the art form that is closest to poetry, of all the ones that I know. For me, it's the rhythm, the specificity of word choice. Sometimes what makes or breaks a joke is a specific word, you know, the content of the joke or anything like that. But also the observational nature of comedy and poetry, and how one it's kind of like that thing you didn't know you knew until you heard it articulated. And I think writers and comedians were always trying to articulate that which we kind of know, but we haven't quite put words to yet. And as a writer, I think one of the most satisfying things that can happen is when I finally find the words to articulate something I've felt for a long time. And I think as a reader, everybody knows that moment where you read something and you're like, yes, I knew that. I just never had put it that way. And I think comedians do that same thing in a way that really the best ones are like poets, philosophers, you know, but I think absolutely, absolutely. Stand-up comedy and poetry have a lot in common with each other.
Yeah, I like the idea of like, experimenting with the word choice. And like, I was just listening to this video where they, I think it was Taylor Tomlinson. They're showing a bunch of her doing the same joke over and over again, where like out of the years and how like a slight word choice produced different. I was like, oh, it's so interesting. She was basically, over the years, she did the same joke, but it was just a slight variation, which they were analyzing, showing how like, oh, you see how that produced a bigger laugh than this, or
And that
kind
has
of
made all
thing.
the difference.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, one word can make all the difference. But at the same time, it's all on, well, the problem with poetry is that you kind of write the poem and you think it's done, but actually it kind of continues to live in the poet. And that's the only thing I wish it was more of an oral tradition, in the sense that we have books, but continue to follow the poet and continue to experiment with the same poems even.
That's interesting, that idea of kind of getting to see the evolution of the poem in real time. There's a literary journal that is trying to do that a little bit as well. And I think the name of it escapes me at this very moment. Oh, it's called Midst, MIDST. And what they do is it's an online journal, and they have the software. So you write a poem into their software and you edit it however you want. And it's sort of a living document. So anybody who goes on there can see the poem in its final form, or they can see the creation of the poem.
Oh,
And
nice.
so I have a poem on there, and if I want to, I could go in there today and edit that poem. And
Yeah.
suddenly the timeline has shifted, even though I
Nice.
haven't edited that poem in a year, you know? And so
Yeah.
it really allows, it's kind of, showing how the sauce is made, you know?
I was thinking of it as like a little video. It's like a little bit of video of you with your cursor going all over the place and kind of, I understand.
Exactly. There's like a timeline. It's
Yeah, nice.
super cool.
That's pretty cool,
It's
yeah.
called Midst.
Yeah.
I think absolutely. I think, I've said, and I've told this to my students that, I've been writing for 25 years now. And I think if I've become a better writer, it's not because I've become a more inspired human being. It's because I've become a better reviser. You
Yeah.
know, it's because I've be gotten better at paying attention to those issues of word choice, syntax, diction, being able to kind of pick the right word and make choices that I think better serve the poem as a whole.
That's interesting. And like, unlike a stand-up, we don't have like the immediate visceral reaction of the crowd, so we have to ultimately kind of determine that based on reading it out loud and like figuring out what kind of be our own audience in a sense, unless you have the chance to do a lot of readings, which is kind of like sometimes difficult.
It's
But
interesting. I just did a reading yesterday with Nicole Hartunian and Ian Haley Pollack, two
yeah.
great writers I'm friends with. One of them is from Queens, one of them is from Westchester. And Ian started reading new poems. And I
Yeah.
could see on his page, it was a Word doc, type printed page, and he had some pen mark edits on it. And he was like, oh, yes, some of these are poems that are really new, but I like reading them to a live audience and get
Yeah.
sort of the energy, where is there a, and even if it's not for a laugh, I think a laugh is easier to hear than sort of an intake of breath or whatever, but you catch how the poem sort of feels out in the world, how the poem feels in your mouth, how the poem sits with a reader and a listener. And who he did that just yesterday. So
Yeah.
funny that you bring that up.
Yeah, it's funny because as I was writing the totality poem, I didn't think of it in terms of, oh, I'm gonna do the cars as a replacement for the totality. So when I finished writing it, I was like, oh, I didn't even get a chance to get to the planets. Like, it missed me the first time. And then I was like, oh, right. As I read it over again, I settled with it. I was like, oh, actually, my mind naturally, supplanted it with a thing that was more living in me. And I was like, oh, I guess it makes sense, but it didn't really land with me until the first time as I was writing it, because it feels too like artificial. I was just like, what's on my mind about the totality? And then I wrote it, and then I was like, oh yeah, now I kind of get it.
Metaphor is there. Yeah.
Yeah,
No,
it's there, but
I'm a big believer in the fact that our poems are generally smarter than us.
what comes out of it's like when you say I'm gonna write the totality and you write something, generally it has a little bit of its own logic of why
Yeah.
you're writing it. Yeah.
Yeah,
So you have to trust our
I try to get out of my poem's way sometimes.
Yeah. Trust our instincts, like improv, even improv and music are two other secondary things that I come up with me with poetry, because improv has a true first guess, best guess, first guess, first instinct, best instinct, and then you know, the music, a musicality of that kind of connects it all. We're kind of following the beat of that.
Yeah, kind of like free writing. And I think that idea of writing toward discovery. And I do both, you know, like I'm a huge advocate of free writing and of your mind is going to go toward the things that it that are interest, you know, are interesting, but not toward the things that the mind finds boring. And then sometimes if you give someone 8 minutes to write something, they may say something that they wouldn't have said if you'd given them an hour.
Yeah.
You know, if they'd had an hour, they would have, their logical brain would have fixed that, quote unquote.
Yeah.
So I'm a big advocate for free writing and then, you know, then revision. And those two, the way those two can work together to create the best possible poem.
Yeah, great, great. So we'll probably leave a few minutes at the end. We have like a few more minutes left, but we'll leave a few minutes at the end for a song so we can talk a little bit about music and how maybe over the years music has influenced you. And, you know, I've been doing like Spotify playlists. And I recently did a storytelling show or like a one-man show where like actually I had a second person ask me questions. So it evolved really differently. And I ended up putting some music on there, orchestral music as the pulse of the show. So we could talk a little bit about music and how that, do you listen to music when you're writing or what do you do? What is your...
I don't listen to music when I write because I am someone who revises and writes out loud.
Yeah.
So I'm always reading my work out loud. And so I need that rhythm, the rhythm of the poem in my head. But I love, I mean, I listen to music all the time.
Yeah.
I'm also a drummer. And I think for me,
I forgot about that.
That connection of rhythm is really there between poems and drums. And sometimes like when I'm reading or when I'm at a poetry reading, I'll find myself like tapping my foot along to the cadence of the language. But no, when I write, I don't listen to music. I know some people who do, and I think if I wanted to, I could maybe do classical music or something that didn't have lyrics in it.
Yeah,
if it had lyrics in it, that would probably throw me off. But that's it. Do you listen to music when you write?
Right before, well, I'm getting myself pumped up, but then I'll put it off as I'm actually writing. But I kind of the afterglow of the music. Like I'll listen a little bit as I'm starting to generate an idea. I'll listen to a little bit of music and then I'll be like, all right, now I've got something. Sure. I pulled on some kind of thread and then I'll shut it off and then I'll try to focus on the cadence of the actual poem. But like, for example, like in that totality poem, it's stuck in the middle with you kind of came up because as I was listening to a playlist, you know, it kind of came some random associative leap there, you know, kind of like, I'll be like, oh yeah, I remember a lyric or like a song. And then I'll try to generate because the breakdown dancer had to do with, like how many playlists down, laying down track for playlists, because those are the kind of the inspiration, if you will, for like for the poems in there. Poets of Queen's Press published that in December 2021 for the listeners. Breakdown Dancer, where I was like, I put actual playlists down to like,
And I know sometimes novelists will do that too. They'll kind of come out with a playlist, like a companion playlist for their novel or something. I think that's really cool.
It's nice to get a feel for the heartbreak and the as expressed in the known canon, so that then you have like a point of reference for the reader to kind of generate a little bit of a rhythm for them. Yeah,
that's neat.
Good.
Do you play music as well? I think you play guitar, right?
I started to learn the basics of guitar, but then I'm always off and on again with that. I didn't keep up with it, but I'm hoping that once I settle down in my career path, I'm hoping to settle down with really learning it in a little bit more focused way. But I have interest in learning it, but I have been disciplined with it. But
my daughter's just started taking guitar lessons. She already takes vocal lessons, and she said, to quote her, you know, in addition to being the lead singer, she also wants to shred. So I'm like, all right, I've indoctrinated her well with with my music tastes.
Nice. All right. So thanks so much for being here. And we'll play. I'll just play a random song, I think, or play something appropriate at the end. Maybe I'll play one of your songs from the what was it? What was the name of your band again?
Well, I was in Dust The Dust Engineers. Then there was Flying J and the Ghost Robber, and he
Yeah.
would. I've been in a few bands, but
Ah, cool.
yeah. Thanks so much, Vijay. This was
Thanks,
a
Doc.
fun chat.
Nice talking to you. Thank you.
You too.
All right, take care.
Every now and then I get a little bit lonely and you're never coming around.
Turn around.
Every now and then I get a little bit tired of listening to the sound of my
Turn
tears.
around.
Every now and then I get a little bit nervous that the best of all the years have gone by.
Turn around.
Every now and then I get a little bit terrified and then I see the look in your
Turn
eyes.
around.
Nothing I can say, a total eclipse of the heart.